Program, you'll notice that there seem to be two introducers to the conference, one giving an introduction and the other giving opening remarks. Is this doubling of introduction simply emblematic of a misplaced Neil Baroque sense of allegory? What's the difference between the two inaugural addresses or opening arias? One brief answer is about 10 minutes. I'm supposed to speak for 10 minutes and skip for 20. And on the basis of early discussion, I know that neither of us will exceed our time, and I will even fall short of mine. This self-denying relation to time will be replicated in an even more condensed fashion in the introductions of the individual speakers that I'll give. Departing from the recent genre of introductions that are longer than the lectures, my introductions will be brief. In fact, they'll be one-liners, simply stating the name of the person, the affiliation, and the name of the talk. This procedure is intended to leave as much time as possible for the talks themselves and for the question period, one of my favorite times in life, and I hope that you will join me in raising questions about the lectures. If the first answer to the question about differences between my introduction and Skip's introduction indicates a departure from a recent convention, my second reason indicates a return, a rather dutiful return to a recent convention. The role of the vaporous meta-introducer, that is to say, the person who introduces the introducer, the meta-introducer, not to be confused with the salacious-sounding transducer that you'll find in your ultrasonic postmodern humidifier, the role of the meta-introducer is, of course, to introduce the substantive introducer. And I'll do this in a second. Before I do, I'd like to make one brief observation. A topic such as race in the humanities is itself, I think, particularly significant, especially sponsored by an organization like the Society for the Humanities. One might argue that such an event is long overdue. I'd simply like to observe that the term humanities in the title of the conference should go into scare quotes, like the term race itself. Both of those should be read in scare quotes. For one thing, our topical range is not restricted to any one discipline or even disciplinary area, such as the humanities. As some of the papers will show, other areas in the social and even the natural sciences are not left untouched by our concerns. And insofar as it's symptomatic of what I would call a species imperialism, or even a disciplinary elitism, the term humanities is as suspect as the term race. As a topic, race in the humanities is situated, I think, in a problematic zone that has an uncertain and potentially thought-provoking status. It may help us to realize that interdisciplinary research is relatively uninteresting if it amounts merely to an association or pastiche of existing disciplines. It becomes significant both intellectually and politically when it enables us to articulate better ways of investigating problematic zones and borders of disciplines in the larger interest of elaborating what Roland Barthes called a new object that belongs to no one, a new object that belongs to no one. And I think that it's very much this problematic zone that justifies a conference like this. I think that the extent to which this new object that's owned by no one can emerge from our papers is something that will, I think, be indicated by the papers themselves and perhaps should be prompted by the questions after the papers. And with that, in a self-effacing way, I disappear from the scene and introduce the real introducer with whom the conference begins, Skip Gaines.
Thank you for getting up so early. I'm not sure that had I not been on the program, I would have been here, like Satya is not here, sleeping to his usual 9 o'clock. I thought it would be fun to do my 20-minute introduction by discussing the nature of race and racism in one subdivision of the humanities, the profession of literary scholarship. So that my talk is called On the Rhetoric of Racism in the Profession. And by the profession, I mean the profession of literature. And when I speak of the MLA, though most of you will know that what those letters stand for, of course, it's the Modern Language Association, which is the godfather, the godmother of our particular branch of the humanities. But let me start with an anecdote. A packed audience sat expectantly at Cornell University as a distinguished visitor walked to the podium to share with his audience his latest theory called ethical criticism. And some of you happened to have been there 2 years ago. In fact, his talk was entitled the ethics of narration, but due perhaps to some wit at our local newspaper, which has, most of us don't know, a black publisher, Pam Johnson, his talk had been advertised as the ethnics of narration. And so the critic, whose name I have to say both modesty and propriety prevent me from disclosing, let's just say his initials are Wayne Booth, announced to the astonished audience not only that his talk had been falsely advertised, much to his annoyance, but if anyone there had come to talk about ethnicity of all things, well, they most certainly should pick up their coats and notebooks and leave, because he knew nothing at all about ethnicity. No kidding, I thought to myself. Then the man proceeded to speak to us for over an hour about his view of value, ethics, and Western white literary criticism in the post-post-structural world in an Anglo-American manner as ethnic as anything that any of us shall do this weekend. The point was, he did not know he was being ethnic, since that word connotes for him some culture of color and not a subdivision of culture itself. Now, the whole performance recalled to mind Edward Said's recent lecture series, again here at Cornell, a marvelous lecture series which I understand should be appearing as a book any time now. Now, during one of Said's lectures, I happened to be seated next to a great literary critic. Let's just say his initials were M. H. Abrams. During his third lecture, Said analyzed the theories of several so-called third world critics, including, among others, C.L.R. James, the great Du Bois, Cabral, Walter Rodney, etc. Every time Said said another strange name, my colleague would turn to me and ask first if I knew their work, and second, if that person were black or white. Now, it happened so often during the talk that my colleague and I arrived at a convenient shorthand. He would raise his eyebrows when he wanted to ask his question, and I, in turn, would merely turn thumbs up or thumbs down, depending on, of course, whether or not African ancestry were involved. And I remember thinking at the end of Said's lecture series that we have a very long way to go before older white academic critics begin to read the great theorists of the black traditions in the same way that we read their theories. And this is the subject I wish to discuss this morning, which I call the subject position. William Bennett and Alan Bloom, the dynamic duo of the new cultural right, have become the easy targets of the new cultural left, which I am defining today loosely and generously as that uneasy, shifting set of alliances formed by feminist critics, critics of so-called minority discourse, a term incidentally that I can't stand, and Marxist and post-structuralist critics generally. Bennett and Bloom, the two symbols of the nostalgic return to what I think of as the antebellum aesthetic position, when men were men and men were white, when scholar critics were white men, and when women and persons of color were voiceless, faceless servants and laborers pouring tea and filling brandy snifters in the boardrooms of old boy clubs. Bennett and Bloom have come to play for us the roles that George Wallace and Orville Faubus played for the civil rights movement, or that Nixon and Kissinger played for us during Vietnam. The feel-good targets, who despite our internal differences and contradictions, we all love to hate. Of course, when Bennett writes into Reclaim a Legacy that, quote, the core of the American college curriculum, its heart and its soul, should be the civilization of the West, unquote, and accounts for this so-called civilizing process in terms of the mastery of Matthew Arnold's The Best That Has Been Thought and Written by white males, for white males, about white males, during the past 3,000 years, we have very little choice but to identify his position as one inimical to our best interests and as antithetical to the larger socioeconomic changes in the academy and in this profession for which so very many of us have been fighting since the civil rights movement and our protests against the war in Vietnam. Unless we fool ourselves into thinking that opinions such as Bennett's and the power that he wields do not have a direct and indirect impact upon our lives in the workplace, we need only recall the racial violence that has swept through our campuses since 1986 alone, at traditionally liberal northern institutions such as UMass Amherst, Mount Holyoke, Smith, the University of Chicago, Columbia, and at southern institutions such as the University of Alabama, the University of Texas, at Duke, and at the Citadel. The implicitly racist rhetoric which Bennett's civilizing mission epitomizes has unfolded precisely as affirmative action programs on campus have become ineffective window dressing operations, necessary evils, quote unquote, maintained to preserve the fiction of racial fairness and openness in the truly academic environment, but deprived of the true power, the power to enforce their stated principles. Statistics gathered from the U.S. Census Bureau, the American Council on Education, and the Federal Education Department's Office of Civil Rights attest to this trend. And I quote, blacks in 1972 constituted 3% of the students in four-year institutions. By 1976, however, reflecting the thrust of effective affirmative action programs, 1,032,000 blacks made up 9.7% of the same college population. But by 1984, just 8 years later, there were only 1,070,000 black students on campus, 8.8% of the total. The Census Bureau reports that the number is still declining, down to 1,049,000 in 1985 and sinking every year. The decline in black graduate enrollment is even more alarming. Whereas 5% of our graduate student population in 1976 was black, only 4% of all graduate students in 1982 were black. And the percentage of blacks receiving doctorate degrees in all fields has been declining steadily and regularly since 1982. According to the National Research Council, in 1986 alone, blacks earned only 820 doctorate degrees, 26.5% fewer than in 1976, 10 years ago. More than half of these doctorates, remember the figures, 820, were in education or in education-related fields, 421. We are in the midst of a crisis, the implications of which shall continue to haunt us for generations. At the same time, there's been a corresponding drop in the number of minority teachers. Blacks, for instance, now constitute only about 1% of all faculty at predominantly white colleges, despite the strikingly visible increase both of black members of professional organizations such as the Modern Language Association and of black and non-black scholars writing about minority discourse of one sort or another, despite the scheduling of panels at the MLA annual convention on these topics and the large numbers of positions being advertised on the MLA job list by traditional English and romantic language departments for experts in so-called minority literatures, the MLA, my own profession, remains overwhelmingly white. And all of this depressing news unfolds in a national climate in which the median income of blacks declined to 56% of the median income of whites in 1984. It was 62% in 1970. And unemployment in 1985 was 14.9% among adult blacks compared to 5.6% among adult whites. The unemployment rate in 1985 among black youths, our potential constituency in the classroom, in the college classroom, was 40%, which means if you go into any city and see 10 black kids standing on the street, four of those 10 are unemployed and probably dropouts from high school. As the National Urban League's 1986 State of Black America report concluded, economic inequity between blacks and whites is greater now than it has been at any time since 1970. The national economic climate, in short, is a disaster for black people. And despite notable successes for individual black scholars, the national academic climate is a disaster as well. As the numbers and percentages of minority students decrease on our campuses, financial support for area and ethnic studies programs and related research and scholarship has decreased dramatically since the Reagan regime came to power as well. Ethnic studies programs attract ethnic minorities as faculty members, and ethnic faculty members tend to, and are able to, intervene in the recruitment and retention of ethnic minorities as undergraduates, graduate students, and as tenurable faculty members on our college campuses. We must, it seems to me, insist upon the continued and increased funding of ethnic studies programs, allowing these emergent traditions to inform new traditions of what we, new definitions, I'm sorry, of what we mean when we say the humanities. I believe that as a body, we must begin to take public stands on the social and political issues that plague our society, our campuses, and our profession. Specifically, I believe that we must take public stands on economic discrimination, on sexism and racism, and sponsor resolutions on specific issues related to affirmative action at all levels on our college campuses, from financial aid and minority recruitment of graduate and undergraduate students to the increased recruitment and retention of minority faculty. I believe that we as a body must accept, confront, and utilize our inherent political power for the social good. I believe that organizations such as the MLA should extend its membership by offering affiliation status to ethnic academic professional organizations such as the African Literature Association and the College Language Association, which was the black MLA, which we all belonged to before the MLA decided we could become members of it. I believe that we should undertake to decenter our profession by actively expanding our membership base in the third world and by seeking funding to enable us to donate copies of our publications, from our individual books to journals such as the PMLA, to third world university libraries. As I've expressed to the Executive Council of the MLA, I believe that we must allow third world scholars to pay their membership dues in their own currencies. Such a small, small thing, but so important, which they are now unable to do because of currency restrictions, inflated national exchange rates, and pitiably low salaries. Most of our colleagues at African universities, for example, simply cannot ever afford to join our professional associations, let alone purchase our annual publications. We must solicit their membership and involvement in these organizations, particularly the MLA, if ever we are truly to be a validly comparative literary association and not, in actuality, the modern language association of the Western world, the same Western world which the Honorable Mr. Bennett seeks to recover, reify, and enshrine. Let us hope for the day when the annual MLA convention occurs in Abidjan or Nairobi, in Managua or Rio, in Delhi or Jerusalem. I believe that we should charge the Executive Council of the MLA to consider the study of literature department curricula, not as William Bennett would have us do, to return to the dark ages of the canon composed of the writings of white men, rather to undertake the ethnic and sexual integration and reformation of ideas of the corpus of literature that our respective literature departments teach, such that comparative literature, for example, will cease to mean merely Latin, French, and German, but will be redefined to include Yoruba, Swahili, and Zulu as well. It is crucial that we do this because William Bennett would have us return to those thrilling days of yesteryear when God was in his heaven and all was white with the world, when the only brand of nationalism that was tolerated in canon formation was white nationalism, and when canon formation was, in fact, the literary version of the grandfather clause used in post-Reconstruction America to disenfranchise the newly freed black ex-slaves. We must engage in this sort of canon deformation precisely because William Bennett is correct. The teaching of literature is the teaching of values, is the teaching of an aesthetic and political order in which none of the members of the black community, the minority community of color, or the women's community were ever able to discover the reflection or representation of their images or hear the resonances of their cultural voices. The return of the canon represents the return of an order in which my people were the subjugated, the voiceless, the invisible, the unrepresented, and the unrepresentable. And I, for one, not only ain't going back there, but am willing to fight anyone who tries to drag us all back there into that medieval never-never land. Rather, we must redefine the notion of the canon, and indeed of the humanities, by defining these to be not merely the important writings of white men, but the important writings of women and men, whether their provenance be Africa or Asia, Europe or the Middle East, the First World or the Third World. Perhaps the most unfortunate and politically dangerous pun under which the writings of non-white thinkers have suffered is that tyrannical connection between the words humanity on the one hand and the humanities on the other. For the humanities, as these have been taught in the West since the time of the trivium and the quadrivium, have embodied only the thought of the thinkers of the West and not the thought of the great cultures of the world. We must encourage an expanded definition of the humanities as the multicultural and multilinguistic writings of the best that the world has had to offer. By integrating the Western tradition with the Asian and the African and the Arabic traditions, we must see ourselves as the professors of a truly human culture, which each day grows ever more vulnerable because nuclear trigger-happy politicians, like Dr. Faustus, seem hell-bent upon flirting with the devil. Let me end by returning to the critique of the subject to which I alluded earlier, the classic critique of our attempts to reconstitute our own subjectivity as women, as blacks, etc., is that of Derrida. And I quote, "This is the risk. The effective law is to build a structure of the subject, and as soon as you say, well, the woman is a subject, and this subject deserves equal rights, and so on, then you are caught in the logic of phallocentrism, and you have rebuilt the empire of law," unquote. To expressions such as this made by a critic who stands on sexism and racism have been exemplary, we must respond that the Western male subject has long been constituted historically for themselves and in themselves. And while we readily accept, acknowledge, and partake of the critique of this subject as transcendent, to deny us the process of exploring and reclaiming our subjectivity before we critique it is the critical version of the grandfather clause, the double privileging of categories that happen to be pre-constituted. Such a position leaves us nowhere invisible and voiceless in the Republic of Western Letters. In this way, those of us in feminist criticism or in African American criticism, for example, who are engaged in the necessary work of canon deformation and reformation, confront the skepticism even of those who are our allies on other fronts. Let me be specific. Those of us working in my own tradition confront the hegemony of the Western tradition generally and of the larger American tradition specifically as we set about theorizing about our own tradition and engaging in attempts at canon formation. Consider the irony. Precisely when we and other third world peoples obtain the complex wherewithal to define our black subjectivity in the Republic of Western Letters, our theoretical colleagues declare that there ain't no such thing as a subject. So why should we be bothered with all that? Long after white American literature, for example, has been anthologized and canonized and recanonized, our attempts to define a black American canon, foregrounded on its own against the white backdrop, are often decried as racist, separatist, nationalist, or essentialist, my favorite term of all. Attempts to derive theories about our literary tradition from within this black canon, a canon, I might add, that must include black vernacular forms as well as written literary forms, are often greeted by our colleagues in traditional literature departments as misguided attempts to secede from a union which only recently and with considerable kicking and screaming has been forged. What's wrong with you people? Our friends ask us with genuine passion and concern. After all, aren't we all just citizens of literature here? Well, yes, we must answer, but no. It is clear, for example, that every black American text must confess to a complex ancestry, one high and low, by which I mean formally literary and vernacular, quote unquote, but also one white and black. There can be no doubt that white texts inform and influence black texts and vice versa, so that a thoroughly integrated canon of American literature is not only politically sound, it is intellectually sound as well. But the attempts of scholars such as Houston Baker, Mary Helen Washington, Nellie McKay, and several others to define a black American canon and to derive indigenous literary theories from within that canon are not meant to refute the soundness of these gestures of integration. Rather, it is a question of perspective, a question of emphasis. Just as we can and must cite a black text within the larger American tradition, we can and must cite it within its own tradition, a tradition not defined by a pseudoscience of racial biology or a mystical shared essence called blackness, but by the repetition and revision of shared themes, topoi, and tropes, a process that binds the signal text of the black tradition into a canon, just as surely as separate links bind together into a chain. It is no more or less essentialist to make this claim than it is to claim the existence of French, English, German, Russian, American, or any other national literature, as long as we proceed inductively from the text to the theory rather than deductively. For nationalism has always been the dwarf in the critical, canonical chess machine. For anyone to deny us the right to engage in attempts to constitute ourselves as discursive subjects is for them to engage in the double privileging of categories that happen to be pre-constituted. You cannot, in other words, critique the notion of the subject until a tradition subjectivity, as it were, has been firmly established. And we must engage in these activities to resist appropriation of the textual peculiarity of the black tradition by and into the larger American or even the Western tradition. We must do so, I deeply believe, to step outside of the circle of opposition which notions of a fixed and transcendent value-free canon traced around us even before we had begun to create fictions for and of ourselves. Many of us believe that the time has come for us to valorize our black textual heritage and to bracket at the margins our white adoptive parentage as we define our own tradition and enshrine its canon, as ironic as we understand this process to be, in institutional, marketable, and teachable forms such as a Norton anthology. To deny the necessity of this process is to ally, for whatever reasons and however inadvertently, with the cultural politics of the new right, as exemplified by that dynamic duo, William Bennett and Alan Bloom. Thank you very much.